Well, hello, Jenny.
Hi.
Oh my goodness, we are back in the studio again.
I know. Is this like 3 weeks in a row? It's like a record.
Yeah, I think so. This is so great. Well, welcome everybody to Changing Perspectives podcast. It is episode 114, which is really exciting. We're fortunate enough to be able to get into the studio way more often than we have been over the past couple months. So we're very fortunate to be with you all. Today, we're going to talk about a parenting episode. Did I even tell you about this?
No, I have no idea what we're talking about today, actually.
Well, welcome, Jenny. Welcome to your own show.
Yeah, thanks.
Before we dive in, how are you today?
I am feeling a little bit stressed and like I'm trying to outrun the clock here, but
I hear you.
It'll get done. Yeah, I have 3 days in a row of 8 sessions in a row without any breaks between them. So Monday too. And Wednesdays, we're recording this on a Wednesday. Wednesday is my busy day because there's a lot of other sort of things that have to happen on Wednesday. So we'll see how I am at 8 p.m. tonight.
Yeah. Well, that's when I get to see you. So yeah, we will see what happens. I would like to first, before we dive in, remind everybody, if you don't already know, that we have a fun opportunity for you all to join us over on Patreon. And remember, Jenny, the other day I told you that my computer was defaulting to German. I'm going to try to get through this by reading it in German because I can't find the translate button.
But that happened to me the other day on Patreon too.
Oh my goodness.
It was on my, I think it was when I was on my phone though.
Anyway, so please.
Well, do you want me to read it? Because
I can do it. Okay. No, I think it'd be kind of fun actually. Okay. So this is just a plug for us to have everybody join us over on Patreon, patreon.com/thechangingperspectivespodcast. We have 3 different levels of membership for you to join us. We have $3 a month, $5 a month, and $7 a month. We have supportive perspectives, extra perspectives, and of course, our most popular, which is our inside perspectives, which gives you early access to new episodes, and the monthly rambling perspectives extra podcast episode, which for this month in April, it was actually an extension, like an extra content for our episode 113, which was all about music and anxiety. If you sign up, you actually get access to the previous ones as well, which is very exciting. We have a members-only online community where you can discuss podcast episodes and connect with other listeners, video recordings, and of course, shout-outs by name, and at least one episode each month of your membership, and access to exclusive Changing Perspectives merch. Should we shout out our Patreon members right now?
Yeah, if you have it there and you can see.
Ooh, I think I can do that on my phone. I know that we just had a new member, right, Jenny?
Yes, Peter.
Peter. Let's see, view page, membership. Nope. Where do I find the people, Jenny?
Well, I don't know. I asked you if you needed my help, so I'm not on that page. This is not us being prepared. I don't know. Sorry. You're not getting the best of me today. Here I am, feed. This is really riveting content.
I don't know. I can't see our people.
Okay. Well, are you logged in as a creator?
Yeah.
It's probably this thing that says patrons on the left-hand side. So Peter, Jillian, Deborah, Carrie, Melanie, and Cole, we will shout them out today.
Jenny for the win. I could not find it at all.
Okay.
It's like I'm an old man who's never had a phone before.
I mean, that's basically accurate.
Pretty much. Anyway, join us over on Patreon, everybody. Lots of exciting stuff. And Patreon memberships allow us to do things like host the recordings and upload to the interwebs and get it all out to everybody. So thank you very, very much to all of our patrons. So now with the housekeeping out of the way, we can move on to the episode proper, which I think we're keeping this. I didn't even realize that there's a connection, but we're keeping this anxiety theme going, I guess, because we all in different facets maybe deal with anxiety at different points in our lives. But we're going to connect that with a parenting topic, and we're going to talk about parenting kids with anxiety.
Great.
Is that okay?
Uh-huh.
Because you had no idea what we were talking about. So
no idea.
Welcome. So I'm going to get Jenny's professional experience a little bit and her opinions. But like we normally do, I've selected an article. This one's from the Mayo Clinic that goes from a year and a half ago. Talks about 9 tools for helping your child manage anxiety. They talk about some do's and don'ts. So we're going to kind of run through this, and we're going to get Jenny's opinion, professional opinion. Before we do that, though, what are some common, I'm going to put you on the spot, what are some common signs and symptoms of anxiety, Jenny, that you've seen professionally or that you know of that you want to share with everybody?
Well, first, I guess I want to say that it's different for everybody. So everybody's anxiety manifests differently, whether you're an adult or whether you're a child. But in general, a lot of people feel anxiety somehow physically in their body. So it could be like a racing heart rate, or it feels like your heart is racing. It feels like a tightness in your chest, or like an elephant is sitting on your chest, a sort of racing sort of thoughts, like these sort of cyclical, never ending thoughts, anxious thoughts, worried thoughts about the future or about the past. There's different types of anxiety. So there can be certain situations that kind of trigger someone to be feeling anxious. But I think that our society kind of does a good job talking about anxiety a little bit more now. So I think people know when they're feeling anxious. Not kids.
Sure. And we're going to tie this into, the pediatric perspective and parenting kids with anxiety. But before we do that, can you talk about the difference between an anxiety disorder and someone just feeling anxious about something?
Well, I think anxiety is a separate issue. I really hate diagnostic criteria. I was just talking about this with a colleague the other day who's a nurse practitioner, just about sort of the diagnostic criteria. A lot of diagnosing all of it comes from something called the DSM.
Mm-hmm.
And so in order for something to be classified a disorder, do I have it? I don't know where it is. It must be over there across the room. If I had it in arm's reach, I was going to show it to you. But these are sort of revised every few years or so by the American Psychological Association. And it's very specific. Like, in order to be diagnosed with this particular disorder, you have to meet these criteria, or at least this number of criteria for at least this number of months, blah, blah, blah. So for it to be classified as a disorder, there's actually specific criteria that would need to be met. Now, my problem with diagnoses is one, oftentimes they're developed by like old white guys on old white guys for the testing. Right, so there are definitely some cultural holes in the diagnosing. Two, diagnoses can sort of stay with you, right? If you've ever been to the doctor and you've looked at sort of your own, I would say if you're over the age of 25 and you look at your own sort of diagnosis sheet, there's like tons of them in there. I think I still have, like, last time I looked at mine, I still had like a strep throat diagnosis from like three years ago. So they just kind of stay on. They can follow you around. And I just kind of disagree with labeling people in general. Also, they're required. So if you're seeing a therapist for therapy, and you're needing your insurance to pay for that, in order for your insurance to pay for that, you have to have your therapist give you a diagnosis. And so I think that there are a lot of people who have diagnoses that don't really technically meet the criteria, but that is our sort of behavioral health model right now.
Yeah.
All right. So the original question. So disorder, for it to be a disorder, it would have to sort of.
I'm going to interrupt you for a second.
Okay.
Because I couldn't quite remember. I'm a tiny bit familiar with the DSM just because of being married to you. And I couldn't remember what it stood for. And I looked it up and it stands for the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. I kind of hate that name a lot.
So positive, right?
Yeah. But like to your point about diagnosing, it's like, why are we going to say disorder? That tells us that it's wrong. Mm-hmm. Right, like something's wrong with you, and we have to label it. We have to label the thing that's wrong with you.
This was the conversation that I was having with a colleague. We were talking about a sort of side note, and I don't know if you see this because your TikTok, your social media algorithm is different than mine.
Thank God.
But there is this whole not movement, but there's this interesting thing that's happening where there are a lot of adults, primarily women, who are recognizing that they meet most of the diagnostic criteria for autism and mostly like high functioning. And they look back at their childhood and they're like, oh my God, if I was that child today, I probably would have had a diagnosis of autism. And a lot of them in large are finding camaraderie and it's a positive experience for them to be able to be like, oh, this is why I have always felt different. This is why some things in life like that, this is why like I've never really understood how to make eye contact with someone. This is why I've always had to be in my head about, am I making too much eye contact or not enough eye contact? But we were talking about this the other day about how like specifically the sort of any neurodivergent disorder is all about how did those people's behaviors disrupt the life of normal people? Really, how are they problematic to others versus how are they problematic to themselves? So to answer your question, there are actual criteria that would need to be met for it to be considered a disorder. There are a lot of people that everyone experiences anxiety at some time. My sort of personal take, I guess professional take as well on anxiety is that it's a good thing. It is one of those holdovers from evolution that is designed to keep us safe, right? It's our brain's way of saying like, this is dangerous. And to sort of trigger our brain to essentially shut off and go into sort of that old fight or flight response, right? That sort of danger. So anxiety is like evolution tapping us on the shoulder and being like, hey, there's something that's not right now and you should focus on it. The problem is that sometimes our brain is oversensitive and treats something little, like getting up and going to the bathroom in the middle of a crowded restaurant. Sometimes it interprets that with the same level of anxiety or fear as like, there's a lion in the bushes and it's going to chase you down and eat you for dinner. So that's where it can become a problem. So anxiety is normal. We all experience it. When does it become a problem? When it sort of impacts your quality of life.
Right. All right. Great. Thank you.
Yeah. Long-winded answer.
No, sorry. That's good though. That's good. And that's basically exactly what, in so many words, the Mayo Clinic article says about the difference between anxiety, being anxious, and quote unquote a disorder. Let's talk about the signs and symptoms of anxiety specifically in children for a second, and we can go into their list of do's and don'ts. Mayo Clinic article says some signs of significant anxiety for children include fatigue. I'm sure this is true of adults, but fatigue, changes in sleep habits such as sleeping too much or too little, irritability, anger, difficulties with concentration, lack of confidence, reassurance seeking, avoidance, and decreased grades. What do you think about those? Have you seen that? I mean, I know you don't have children.
I don't see children
in your practice, but
in talking to patients that I have that have children with anxiety, or just friends, or people we know personally, yeah, I think that all is pretty spot on. Did you say irritability?
Yeah.
Was that? Yeah.
Yeah.
I think, all right. So when we're talking about kids and we're talking about emotion, it sort of parallels what we see when we talk about children who are grieving. So if you go like all the way back to, I don't know, probably one of our first 10 episodes where we talk about children's grief, children tend to be labeled. And so their behaviors, their emotions tend to be labeled as either like good, bad, or mad.
Yeah.
Right. Like, so oftentimes children's anxious presentation is labeled as problematic.
Yes.
So I think there's probably a lot of kids who, whether it's on a sports team or in a family home or particularly in a school setting, whose behaviors are actually a manifestation of their anxiety. That is how their anxiety is presenting, but they're being kind of labeled as problematic. The child is problematic or bad. When really the child is probably anxious and is struggling with how to manage that.
Right. Or like the symptoms of like avoidance and decreased grades, those could be labeled as, oh, they're just not a good student, or they're lazy, or they don't care about their grades or schoolwork, but,
or they're like a jerk or whatever.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But they could legitimately be suffering from anxiety and not knowing how to deal with it. Mm-hmm. The Mayo Clinic article goes on to talk about some physical symptoms that may present in children and teenagers. And those include stomach aches, headaches. They can also experience increased heart rate, rapid breathing, restlessness or jitteriness, trembling, feeling twitchy, dizziness, nausea, chest tightness and pain, kind of what you talked about earlier with the feeling of like an elephant on your chest. I mean, I think it's really helpful for us as parents or anybody that is a teacher or a coach or something to understand that this is a possibility for kids, that it's not just, you know, them being, again, quote unquote, bad kids.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I would say I'd be hard pressed to find a time where it would ever be okay to just label a child as like a bad kid, right? Like, I don't think there's no such thing as a bad kid. I think on the whole, there's no such thing as a bad person, like a bad adult. And so if you're seeing problematic or behavior that is problematic from a child and you're in the role of a coach or a parent or a teacher, it's always helpful to sort of take a step back, not label that child by that action, by their behavior, by their attitude, but instead question, where could this be coming from? And what might the child need in terms of support? And I think we can talk, I see your little message in the chat. I think we can talk about our personal experience as parents, but let's just not name which child.
Sure.
It is.
Because I just want to say we've legitimately seen some of these symptoms, like decreased grades and that kind of stuff, and avoidance, irritability. Like, we've actually seen it as a parent,
and we've also seen what we now understand are panic attacks.
I was just gonna say that because the article goes on to talk about supporting a child in that aspect, because I think we've talked about panic attacks before on the show.
And we didn't, I don't think we talked about it in this way, the way that our child experiences that.
No.
So it doesn't, I'm really super scattered. I feel so bad for any of my patients today. We've talked before about how depression often, some gender stereotypes here, but often in males, depression can more often than not present, or can often present as irritability, not like the sad, despondent, that is you.
Me.
Yes. I was just thinking about our exchange in the car yesterday on the way to the gym. That was like depressed Josh, right? But also could easily be misinterpreted. Can I swear on this?
No.
Okay. It could easily be interpreted as like jerky Josh, but really it's depressed Josh. Like, that is, these are depressive symptoms. So that irritability. anxiety can help happen that way too. And so panic attacks, when we think about panic attacks, which is when like the anxiety sort of triggers your brain to really kind of fire that fight or flight response, and kind of all logical thinking shuts off and your brain is like, we are going to die right now. We are dying. That thing we're scared of is killing us. We're going to die. We need to do something about it. And for some people that might mean like they freeze. Mm-hmm. For some people that might mean that they lash out. I think when we often think about panic attacks, we think about it, or an anxiety attack, we think about it how we see it in the movies or the media, right? With people like who are hyperventilating, maybe needing to like breathe into a paper bag, who are going over and over again, sort of repeating the same kind of worry out loud, who are maybe like running away, those things, right?
Yeah.
For one of our children, the way that their anxiety, their panic attacks manifest, and we have finally figured this out, is anger and lashing out. Not like physically lashing out, but like really kind of looking like a jerk, looking like someone who is just sort of oppositionally defiant and just wants to break rules.
Yeah.
And so we've seen this in some sporting events. And after some work together, our child was able to say, like, that's a panic attack for me. Like when that's happening, I don't know what's happening. I like black out. He identified the trigger, right? And then was able to tell us that like, then he like blacks out, and it comes from a place of anxiety. Mm. And we miss that, right? Like we are people who deal with our own anxiety and depression. Yeah. And I work in the field, and because it was happening in a public place, my brain was like, oh my God, what are people thinking of him? And what are people thinking of us? And I didn't even go to, could this be how the anxiety is manifesting itself?
Yeah. And I think that was a good connection that you just made, and a good point, because the Mayo Clinic article talks about, imagine being a child in a situation and having that first panic attack and not knowing what it is.
Yeah.
You know, that's got to be so hard.
So scary, right? Yeah. And to like not be in control of your behavior and know that people are maybe thinking bad things about you, or you know, you're asking to like go to the bathroom in math class and your math teacher is like, no, you went to the bathroom last period. And yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
True story.
So what do we do as parents and teachers and coaches? What do we do? So we're going to go through these lists. And I like a lot of what this article is saying. So I assume that you and I are going to agree with most of these, but we'll just go through these and see what they say here. So these are the do's, right? How we can support children as they are dealing with anxiety. Number one, identify triggers. A helpful first step is for you and your children to become aware of and recognize what causes them to feel intense anxiety. So the things you and I were just talking about. So identifying triggers. How important is that, Jenny?
Well, it's crucial. When I talk about it with my patients, I think about what is the anxiety trying to tell you? And often if we drill down, the thing that your brain is anxious about, is rooted in reality. It's just that your brain sort of amplifies it a little bit too much. But often there's something that's not working. Like you're not taking good enough care of yourself. You've got too much on your plate, or you've got people in your life or job situations in your life that are not working for you and that are pretty toxic. And your brain is like, something's wrong. I don't know what's wrong, but something's wrong. And so uncovering that what's wrong, like where is that coming from, can be really important. And sometimes, what's wrong is that just like something happened that sort of reinforced an anxious pattern, often in childhood, right? Like, your head was itchy. I won't talk about like itchy heads and kids, but I'm thinking about, that four-letter word that parents get scared of.
Yes.
but like something happens and it reinforces that you
great
should be
episode
scared.
Of The Office, by the way.
Yes. Anyways, I don't know. I lost my train of thought there because I was going to go off the rails there. So what was the original question? How important is it to find the root?
Identify the triggers. Yeah.
Really important. Really hard though sometimes. Sometimes takes a lot of work to kind of drill down to what that is.
Well, and once you identify the triggers, some of these next tips, what the Mayo Clinic article is saying is, will help you once you see that, okay, that's clearly your trigger. So what do I do now? So the next thing would be to validate and empathize. Children's thoughts and emotions or experiences are real to them. It goes on to say, no matter how you think or feel about the experiences, it is important for your children to feel heard, validated, and understood. What do you think about that, Jenny?
I mean, yeah, 100%. I think that we all need that. Even adults need that.
Seriously. Sometimes you just need someone to listen, right? And that's true of children, and especially children dealing with anxiety.
Absolutely.
And to not say that your feelings are wrong, right?
No, because your feelings are never wrong.
Right. Okay. So number three, challenge unhelpful thinking. Mm-hmm. So this says, ask your children to talk you through the thoughts they are experiencing that are unhelpful and causing them distress, such as, quote, I'm going to fail my test and then fail my class. So once you know what thoughts your children are telling themselves, you can work with them to identify more realistic and helpful thoughts.
We're kind of getting into like a lot of CBT stuff, right? If you go back to listen to our most popular episode, which is our two-part episode on CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, a lot of the CBT interventions are things that often are go-tos when you're working with children around anxiety, because it's about kind of retraining your brain, or for the first time, training your brain to respond to those scary things. I like to think about it in terms of taking the power away from the anxiety. So often when we're anxious, whether we're children or adults, we're in this like, what if, what if, what if, what if, we're catastrophizing, we're worried about the worst thing that could happen, and we're sort of saying it. And sometimes I think one of the best things to do is to take the power away from the what if and answer it. Okay, so what is the worst thing that happens? What happens if you do fail this test and you fail your math class? Like, what does that actually mean? What can we do about that? What are the options then? Doesn't mean it's going to happen, but let's give ourselves some hopefulness and some insight about what could happen if the worst thing does happen. And oftentimes when people are able to kind of like lean into that and be like, oh, well, the world wouldn't end. I wouldn't get kicked out of school. I wouldn't lose my friends. I wouldn't like lose the ability to play sport, whatever, fill in the blank there, right? Yeah. But being able to identify that is helpful to sort of stop the catastrophizing. And then you can work backwards to sort of figure out, okay, well, how can we maybe prevent that from happening? And what are the things that we know to be true?
And so the opposite of catastrophizing, in my opinion, would be like unrealistically positive. Right. So that is like almost like toxic positivity, such as, you know, for this example, and Mayo Clinic talks about exaggerated ideas. So the sample here, example they give is like if a child anxious about a test that they have and saying that I'm going to fail the test and I'm going to fail my class. But to your point, you know, what will happen if, let's talk about that. And being careful not to say things like, you're going to pass and you're going to be fine. It's going to be great, right? Just think that way. Think positive, right? That's that's not a way to deal with the unhelpful thinking.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think, yes, I think that does sort of lean into sort of the realm of toxic positivity. I think I also refer to it as sort of balancing it out. Like if you're going to be worried about sort of the negative outcomes here, okay, I get that. Let's also try to add in thinking about what if I get an A? What if I get a B? What if I get a C? What if I sit down and it's easier than I thought? What if I spend some time tonight studying and I walk in tomorrow feeling a little more confident? Like, let's also sort of give some attention to the positive what ifs.
Yeah.
Like, because that sort of it balances, right? If you think of sort of a scale, right? If we're only thinking about the negative, then that's what we kind of see. And if we sort of give ourselves permission to also think about, like, what if it works out? That can be helpful.
Yeah.
Focusing on one over the other exclusively, I think, is never a good idea.
Agreed. All right. Ready for number four?
I am.
We've talked about this a lot on the show, actually. Practice deep breathing.
Yeah.
Deep belly breathing is a tool to help calm, refocus, and think clearer. You talk a lot about square breathing. Do you want to give new listeners a quick refresh on square breathing?
I mean, there's a million different sort of tips and tools and strategies you can use around breathing. Sort of the key here is to bring you back into your physical body, right? Sort of bring you back into the present and having you become more aware of who you are, where you are, what is going on. So sort of taking you out of sort of the brainstem, like the base part of your brain, the most primitive part of your brain, the reptilian part of your brain. We've seen it referred to in a lot of different ways. Taking you sort of out of that and allowing the rest of your brain to kind of turn back on. Coming into our bodies can allow that to happen because it's harder to sort of focus in both spaces. So breathing is one of the simplest ways to do that because we're breathing without really thinking about it. We're breathing without being conscious about it. So we very much can focus on our breathing because it's happening all the time. So I like square breathing because I'm a visual person and because I think it's easy enough for folks to pick it up quickly and also complex enough that it keeps people focused on the breath. So essentially it just breaks up your breathing into a square. A square is a shape with four equal sides, right? So it has you inhale for four counts. That's one side. The next side would be holding that breath for four counts. The third side would be exhaling for four counts and then holding again for four counts. So you broke your breathing up into four equal parts. This is really helpful to do or important to do, not when you're anxious, so that you can practice with it and figure out for you what rhythm works, because you don't want to be breathing so quickly that you're like hyperventilating, and you don't want your counts to be so slow that you're like gasping for air. You want it to be slow and quick enough that you're taking slow, controlled, deep breaths, and running through that a few cycles can be really helpful. And what that does is it sort of takes the focus off the anxious thoughts and allows the other sort of more practical parts of your brain to turn on. Now, if you don't like square breathing or box breathing, you don't have to do it. There's like 37,000 other breathing exercises that you can do, but that is my go-to one. I didn't create it.
Sorry to cut you off. The article has some examples of breathing exercises to do with kids, because maybe box breathing or square breathing might be tough for like a 6-year-old.
It would be tough for a 6-year-old, right? Because as adults, we're thinking like visualizing that in your head. And that's a really kind of abstract concept. So I would say not going to work for most kids. Maybe once you're getting into adolescence, that might work.
So they talk about fun way to guide this exercise includes pretending to smell a flower, which is cool, interesting. And then pretending to blow bubbles or pretending to blow out birthday candles.
Yep.
Which I think is pretty cool.
Yeah. And also having children like place, this also works for adults, but like place their hand on their chest, their hand on their belly, and really kind of feel what happens to their body when they're taking deep breaths in and when they're blowing out as well. Really, I think all of everything we're talking about when we're talking about mental health, we're really talking about taking what we know kind of works for adults and seeing if we could break that down into children's terms and terms that are going to work for kids. Because often it's the same kind of process going on. It's just going on in the sort of limited capacity of a child's mind.
All right. So we have a few more of these left, and I think we have about 10 or 12 minutes left in our time to record. So, all right, next is number five, break down tasks. says, break down tasks into smaller steps so the overall process feels less daunting. For younger children, have random rewards throughout the process to positively reinforce their behavior. Yeah, I mean, that makes sense to me.
Yeah, sure. I think that's a great strategy for everybody.
Mm-hmm. Number six, role play. If your children are worried about specific situations, role play these feared situations to help them prepare. Mm-hmm. Like asking a teacher for help or inviting friends over.
Yep. So you know, and some kids might really get into that, right? Like let's pretend that I'm Miss So-and-so and you're you or whatever, right? Some kids might really get into that. Some kids might be like, no, I'm not doing that. So you can still sort of take those components and say, okay, like let's sort of talk about what would a script be? Like, what could you say or what might you say? Or maybe, you know, you could think about saying this. So you're still kind of giving them the tools of a role play without them having to go through maybe what might be awkward for them.
Okay, so number seven of the do's, this is the last things you should do. Build overall confidence. It says, so have your children perform tasks around the house to contribute to the family, build confidence. Offer your children opportunities to face challenges. It's important to praise their efforts and focus less on results. Yeah, for sure. I think that will translate into whatever situation is giving them mm-hmm. you know, the anxiety.
Yeah. And really what we want is again, for adults and children, we sometimes it's about doing away with the thing that's causing you anxiety, right? For some people, oftentimes, people are in really toxic job work environments. I'm thinking about adults. And that's triggering their or relationships. And in fact, this came up today on the podcast I was listening to, because this morning at the gym, I was listening to a podcast about Vanderpump Rules, because I shared last week that I sometimes do that. Yeah, Lala's podcast drops on Wednesday. So I was listening to it this morning.
Wait, and isn't the show out tonight too?
Yeah, but she does it a week late. So she records it. So it was about last week's episode.
Okay.
Anyways, she was talking about Ariana. So there's the whole Scandoval thing. If you don't know, you don't need to know really quickly. This couple had been together for 10 years and then there was an affair, a whole thing. But she was talking about how Ariana had been so anxious and so depressed. And then a few days ago was talking to Lala and she's like, my anxiety is gone. I'm not anxious anymore. And I think we could say, well, because Ariana's brain was like, hey, you're not in a healthy relationship. This relationship is not making you happy. And that's where that anxiety was coming up from, this like disconnect between what the situation you're in and the situation that you should not be in or should be in. So sometimes with our anxiety and sometimes with kids, that does mean changing an environment. So that you're not sort of triggered by that situation. Oftentimes, though, it's not about that. It's about building competency and comfort in dealing with the scary thing, right? So building kind of distress tolerance, your ability to kind of sit in that scary place, your ability to get up and walk across the restroom, even though you're anxious because people might be looking at you. And so we want to give kids opportunities to sort of have little successes, that if they're scared of public speaking, that doesn't mean that like, okay, tomorrow you are going to speak in front of your entire school and see how that goes. Maybe that means
good luck.
Yeah. Right. Not that we would sort of talk about like a kind of laddered approach. Like what would be kind of one little rung you could take on the ladder that would be scary-ish, not terrifying, but would be just a little bit out of your comfort zone, would make you a little anxious. And let's have you get some success and positive experiences around that. And then we'd take that to the next level. We want to be doing that with kids who are experiencing anxiety so that their anxiety isn't this like big, scary monster that they have to avoid, but it's this thing that they recognize as part of their life and they're developing ways for it not to be so loud.
Right. Yeah. And by the way, that is somebody's actual first name, Lala, for those that aren't familiar with Vanderpump.
Well, her real name. Do you know her real name?
I actually don't.
Her real name is Lauren.
Ah, okay. I prefer Lala. Anyway, these last two are the don'ts. Okay. And we actually kind of already talked about these or referenced these at the beginning of our conversation, but number eight is again, something you should not do is label emotions as bad. Mm-hmm. We talked about that earlier. Mm-hmm. Stay away from labeling their thoughts, emotions, and experiences as good or bad. For example, do not say it is bad to think you will fail. Because sometimes they're going to hear that and think, I'm bad.
Yeah. Well, because kids are so concrete, right? And they're so selfish. And I don't mean that in a bad way. Like, their job as children is to be self-centered, even as adults. I mean, even as adolescents. And so, yeah, if we're labeling a feeling as bad, it's very easy for them to then label themselves as mm-hmm. bad. Again, though, this is something that adults can be watchful for, because we do that to kids, right? Yeah. Like, bad kids. I always argue that none of your feelings are ever wrong. Like, what you feel is what you feel. You can't control what you feel. There should be no judgment about what you feel. Like, your feelings are valid. Mm-hmm. You can't act freely on any of those feelings, right? Like, there are rules and consequences around what you do with your feelings, but how you feel, it's totally cool.
Yeah.
That's what you're feeling. So, like, let's not judge our feelings. Let's instead focus on, okay, what can we do with that feeling? This morning, or this week, in my Understanding Your Grief, like, online series, and then there's the Facebook group, I always pose a couple discussion questions each week. And this week, I'm talking about anger with them. Like, how does your anger show up for you in your grief right now? And so many of them are talking about the fact that they don't express their anger. They hold it in, they feel it, and then it spills out. It just sort of bubbles over, and often onto people that don't deserve it, that it's not about. But that's kind of our society. We don't really give ourselves permission to do something with our, like, yeah. bad feelings, like anger or jealousy. And so that's important to talk about with kids, right? Like, not labeling the feelings as good or bad, but also recognizing that we need to do something with those feelings. Mm-hmm. We need to sort of put them somewhere. So yeah, that's just the piece I would add to that.
All right. So finally, number 9, and this is, again, the don't, what you should not do, is you should not minimize anxiety. Do not minimize your children's experiences and tell them to, quote, just do it or just suck it up. Their feelings of anxiety are real and they're suffering. Yeah. I mean, we talked about that earlier. So labeling them as bad and minimizing what they're feeling, minimizing the anxiety, is obviously something you should not do
for anybody, like, in any situation, right? Like, yeah. We don't need to minimize anyone. Just as any feeling is valid and shouldn't be labeled as, like, good or bad, they're also valid. They're real feelings.
Yeah. All right, Jenny. Well, that was the whole list. And again, this is from the Mayo Clinic, and the title of the article is 9 Tools for Helping Your Child Manage Anxiety. This is published in late 2021. And the author is Dr. Deirdre Paulson, who's a psychologist in family medicine in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. So, Dr. Paulson, Jenny and I like your article, and we agree with a lot of the things. Yeah.
And listen, it is very rare that Jenny likes an article that Josh brings to these sessions. Often what is this person? Are they a therapist?
By the way, this is a podcast episode, not a session.
What did I say?
Session.
Was this author
one of your patients?
Was this author a therapist?
Psychologist.
Okay.
PhD. Yeah.
Okay, great. Mm-hmm. I was going to say something else. Oh,
I gave you the link, by the way, in the chat.
Yeah, I'll put it in the show notes. And let's see, we're recording this in April 2023. One of my sticky note goals for this year is to follow the model of my Understanding Your Grief series and make an Understanding Your Anxiety series. Yes. So sort of same thing, like, probably 5 modules, self-paced, go at your own pace. Probably not a Facebook group, because I feel like, I don't know, that just might be a little more challenging to sort of moderate and control. So I don't know. So if you're listening to this sort of the latter half of 2023, I'd be on the lookout, because that is what's coming. What's coming next is modifying the grief course for professionals, and then moving into anxiety. Nice. For folks. Yeah.
All right, Jenny. Well, do you have any final thoughts on navigating parenting a child with anxiety?
It's really hard. I mean, I think parenting a child period or an adult or a baby, it's all really hard, right? Like it's just hard. And nobody's perfect and you're going to make mistakes. So all those mistakes. And also recognize that if you're a parent yourself who struggles with anxiety, or you know other adults who struggle with anxiety, it doesn't necessarily mean that if your child is struggling with anxiety, that's going to look the same. So really think about getting support for yourself around that and support for your children, your child. And don't be afraid of medication support either. Not that I'm saying, you know, throw meds at kids or anybody, but be open to that.
Yeah.
And trust your gut and don't be afraid to advocate for your child, because you know your child pretty well. And we've had to do a lot of advocating. With some teachers are better than us.
I have
some people are better than others at recognizing anxiety and depression than others.
Yeah, I agree. And I just had a thought, Jenny, about another podcast episode topic. Mm-hmm. Have we done anything on men's mental health?
I don't know. We're 114 episodes in. I would say even if we have, it's been a while. And so that's something to dive into.
I think it's important because, not that this is part of it, but some of the things you just said sort of inspired me to say this, but so I think there's so many guys out there that could use mental health support in terms of either therapy or medication that don't get it, that are scared.
We talked about it. It was did we release it as a podcast episode? We did a live when the whole like DAC.
Yes. That was a live and a pint size, I think.
Pint size.
Skip Bayless was saying crap about Dak Prescott's mental health.
Yeah. Yeah, we talked about it then. Yeah.
I think we do another, just a regular episode proper, an hour long on that.
I agree. I also received an email from one of our Patreon members requesting a specific topic. I'll just read it to you really quickly. Do you know who Chet Baker is, Joshua? Chet Baker.
No, it's not ringing a bell.
They said,
not going to try to make it up.
Has anyone ever told Josh that his voice sounds like Chet Baker's horn?
Yeah. Yes. Chet Baker, the jazz trumpeter. Yes.
If Chet Baker's horn spoke in English, the super rich mid-range baritone is totally therapeutic in and of itself.
Where did this come from?
If one of our new Patreon members. Oh,
very nice.
Then they said, have the two of you done a podcast on the nuts and bolts of business meetings for partners? A podcast where you explain what you talk about in a bit of granular detail, kind of like business meeting 101. So I think he's talking about like when we do staff meetings.
What does
that actually look like? And I don't think that we've done a full episode on that. So like, do you use spreadsheets? How do you talk about credit card usage? How do you navigate the tenderness around money? Are there helpful hints about what strategies have been helpful for the relationship and for financial long-term stability? They talked about how they're going to start business meetings, but they're really mindful of grenades and landmines that exist in that landscape that typically couples tend to avoid. So I think if you've got a little working list of stuff we might talk about, maybe we do men's mental health next, and then maybe we return to a relationship podcast and we talk specifically about staff meetings.
Relationship. All right, just writing this down. And I also have a to-do list now personally to get into Chet Baker a little bit. I'm a jazz fan, big bop and jazz, Dizzy Gillespie, Charlie Bird Parker, Bill Evans, Miles Davis, of course. I haven't really dove into Chet Baker that much. So I need to do that.
Okay. Yeah. Sounds like something you can do this afternoon with yourself. One final thing is I am jealous that you have stolen that picture that is behind you in your office.
I asked you.
I know you did ask me. I used to have a set of photos that our oldest took when he was like 7, 8. I don't know, with like a little camera. He went around our yard one day in the spring and took these gorgeous photos of our flowers. and Josh has one right behind him, and I'm a little jealous.
I have another one too.
Do you have the yellow one? Yeah. I think I have two yellow ones.
I think I can show you. There it is.
Yeah, I really like that one.
Yeah.
So that must mean that I have, oh, there, that's your picture. That must mean that I have the third one probably in my desk over in my office closet. All right, cool.
Should we wrap this up, Jenny?
We should wrap this up. Yeah.
Okay, cool. Well, thank you all for joining us today. Jenny, thank you for guiding us through this Parenting a Child with Anxiety episode. So Jenny's going to share the Mayo Clinic article link in the show notes. Be on the lookout for episode 115. Who knows, maybe we'll be in the studio again next week for the fourth or third week in a row, whatever it is. And don't forget to check out our Patreon page, patreon.com/the Changing Perspectives Podcast. Any other final thoughts, Jenny?
No, thank you for the topic.
All right, you're welcome. Everybody have a fantastic day, weekend, night, whenever you're listening to this. And say bye, Jenny.
Bye, Jenny.